Just as a scene setter, it won't have escaped your attention that 40 years ago, President Nixon famously declared war on cancer, and at that time signed off on a bill which released what was eventually to become very substantial sums of research money, currently running at $5 billion a year for the National Cancer Institute. So that this became a major scientific program, and there have been a lot of attempts in the last few weeks and months to say, well, what have we achieved after 40 years of this effort? Well, this graph here is an interesting one. It's deliberately blank because you're supposed to guess what it is, but I'll tell you right away. It's the number of deaths, curiously enough, in Ecuador, but it's the same in any country that you like to name, number of deaths from tuberculosis. And what you see is this precipitous decline round about the end of World War II as a result of the development of antibiotics. And so this major, major killer disease was suddenly brought under control. Of course, it's coming back a little bit now due to the evolution of resistance. But the point is that this story of the medical profession making dramatic advances against major killer diseases had become the norm in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so it was not unreasonable when President Nixon decided that cancer had to be next to expect that maybe within, he thought, 10 years, there would be very substantial improvements. Well, these are the statistics, and as you will see, this is for particularly well-known cancers, and as you will see, there has been some progress. What we've got here is survival rate, not death rate, so it works the other way. There has been progress, but it's been slow. We don't see any dramatic breakthrough, the long-awaited breakthrough on cancer that we read about all the time in the media. The promise of a miracle pill that will just make cancer go away simply has not been realized. So we mustn't denigrate the progress that has been made, but I think we'll recognize that cancer remains a major, major problem throughout the world. This compares progress with cancer against other major killers, heart diseases, if I can pronounce this, cerebrovascular diseases, pneumonia and influenza, and cancer. And you see the cancer is a slight improvement, but nothing like as dramatic as the others. And now, an issue here is that cancer tends to afflict older people, and here's a couple of graphs illustrating this. And so as life expectancy has increased in the developed world, more and more people are getting cancer. And so what you need to look at is not so much the survival rate as the incidence rate, because of course everybody dies of something, and a lot of people who in the past may have contracted cancer nevertheless died of something else. But as other diseases are brought under control, this is set to overtake heart diseases as the major source of death in the United States. I'm grateful to George Post for providing the following information from a talk he gave recently about the annual cost of cancer care just in terms of drugs. These are some popular drugs and the cost for annual treatment. And you see that these can be well over $100,000 per year. And with more and more people getting cancer, the impact of cancer care on the economy of the United States and other countries is rising remorselessly. And it's quite clear that something has to give. We can't go on like this. George would probably be able to comment, but it's well known that many of these drugs have effectively zero impact on the outcomes of, in some cases, a large majority of patients. But they're routinely given even when they don't work on the majority of people. That's a political issue. I don't want to get into that. But this is a scene setter simply saying that cancer is obviously a major problem, and in spite of the very large sums of money being spent on cancer research, there's still a long way to go. And it was in that spirit that the National Cancer Institute courageously set up 3 years ago this network of PSOCs. And here is the network. Bob Austin sitting there has mentioned that he runs the Princeton one, and here we are in Arizona. Our own PSOC, just by way of background, is a partnership between ourselves, the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, and the Mayo Clinic locally here in Scottsdale. So we like to think of ourselves as the think tank, and clinical collaborators provide us with the cell lines and tissues that we need for the experimental work. I don't have time to explain our experimental program here, but any of you who are interested or who might be staying on could probably, we could arrange for them to see around some of the labs, particularly in biodesign. If anyone's going over to biodesign for John Pepper's talk, they'll have a glimpse of that operation there. So I now want to move on to the substantial part of my own contribution to this subject. I came into it completely out of the blue with no prior knowledge or understanding of cancer biology. Indeed, the last formal instruction I had in biology was at the age of 16. So I've had to learn very fast. And some of what I have to say to you now will be rather trivial or obvious or maybe just plain wrong. But I'm going to go through it anyway because we, as you know, we're a mixed bag here of contributors. And so there will be people, for example, in astrobiology that might need to be brought up to speed in cancer biology and vice versa. So let me just take you through this, partly by way of a scene setter. And I should have said in my opening remarks that although most of you here have 45-minute slots and titles and have come with some sort of presentation, we lay great stress in these workshops on really informal discussions and not so much on set-piece presentations. So at any stage, you can stop me. We like to try to keep to time. We do have some discussion time built in. But the important thing about the workshops is not so much that we just get educated in what other people are doing, but we really try to move the subject along. A successful workshop is one where people go away having forged new collaborations or come up with genuinely new ideas and ways of thinking about whatever the subject is. And so it's my intention, I have this sort of grandiose notion, that by coming into the subject from outside, I can help change the culture of research. I'm obviously not going to be able to compete on their home turf with cancer biologists and oncologists. That would be ridiculous. But what I can try and do is to enlarge their thinking and facilitate exchanges between people who might be working in a rather narrow field of cancer biology and the broader scientific community, because it's in those exchanges and that interaction that progress is often made. And so that's the intention. So it's in that spirit I'm delivering this introductory talk. It may seem extraordinary because cancer touches every family on the planet, and we're so used to it, we sort of take it for granted, it's there. And what is cancer? In the simplest terms, a cell somewhere in the body starts to proliferate uncontrollably, and then if left unchecked, its descendants will spread around the body, so-called metastasis, and 90% of cancer deaths result from this metastatic process. So if we could only arrest or slow the metastatic process, we would have substantially cracked the problem. We don't have to, as it were, cure cancer. We have to try to understand this process. And incredibly, you will hear many narratives about what's going on, and each step of the way in this process, you will maybe hear explanations for what the change is taking place in cells. But the overall question of why it is that cells come, with this ability to proliferate uncontrollably and spread around the body, nobody really knows. There is no theory of cancer in that sense. Again, it's my dream that as a result of this PSOC exercise, we will emerge from it with some sort of well-grounded theory of why cancer happens. Because if we understand why it happens, we're with a chance of doing something about it. Now, what I just said But there may be people here who object to that and say, no, we completely understand what's going on here. Let's have that particular discussion a little later on. I just wanted to start with this sort of dramatic statement. Now, the first thing that, when I came into this field, because I suppose I have been seduced a bit by media coverage that that progress against cancer is fantastic, and that there's, you know, all sorts of hope, and there's a drug that's being tested now that seems to be exactly what we want, and so on. So I had the impression that there was fantastic progress being made, but everything I hear from my cancer biology colleagues convinces me it's a very, very tough problem. And cancer is a formidable enemy. And so my first question is, well, why? You know, why is it why is it so resistant to treatments, to the very best that the body itself and the physician can throw at it? What is the secret of its extraordinary success? So I'm going to nail my colours to the mast and make this strong statement that to me it looks like something pre-programmed and deterministic, not something sort of like a random aberration that makes it up as it goes along. In other words, it seems to me like cells come with a sort of cancer subtext or cancer program built into them, and that something triggers the release of that. And we'll discuss that as we go along. So that's the basic idea. Now, for those of you who don't have a cancer background, here is the story I've just said in pictures. We'll find that somewhere in the body, cells begin to form a tumour, a primary tumour. They grow uncontrollably. That doesn't necessarily, incidentally, mean that they multiply very fast. It just means that they don't die. As you probably know, cells... most normal somatic cells can undergo apoptosis, programmed cell death, and so long as they do that on cue, then all is well. But if something switches that off, and that happens in cancer, you get this uncontrolled growth. Eventually, and we're going to come onto this in a moment, because of hypoxic conditions, you have put a lump of cells where they don't belong, don't get enough oxygen, they engineer their own blood supply. Very clever example of cooperation. Eventually they get fed up with those conditions and cells start to come off and enter the bloodstream or the lymphatic system, swept around the body, circulating tumor cells, and then transported around and then stick to the sides of blood vessels and extravasate, that is, they push their way through the walls into other organs. And most of them don't cause a problem, but those fractions that do can form secondary tumours in other parts of the body, and that's the metastasis we've been talking about. And then the prognosis looks very bad at that stage. The question is this just a series of unfortunate accidents, or is this part of, I don't want to really use the word design, but you know, a pre-programmed response to stress or a carcinogen or something? This concept of cancer being pre-programmed is certainly not my idea. Robert Weinberg, who is famous for his reviews of the state of cancer research, recently wrote, in fact, reviewing cancer after 40 years, there's a multifaceted cell biological program packaged together to empower cancer cells within primary tumours to execute multiple steps of the invasion metastasis cascade. So notice the word program. So that sort of hints that cells come with some internal software that can enable them to do this. Now, let me just run through briefly the hallmarks of cancer. These will be familiar to all of the people here who work in cancer biology, so they can just tune out for a few minutes. But for those who aren't, the purpose of this list is really not so much to go one by one through the clever things cancer cells can do, but just to impress you with the very large number of qualities or survival tricks that cancer cells can deploy as part of this strategy. I've mentioned switching off apoptosis. The body comes with all sorts of mechanisms to hold tumours in check. Tumour suppressor genes, for example, cancer cells can suppress those suppressor genes, switch them off. Something that I think is deeply significant, and we'll come back to it, is that I mentioned that cancer cells, if it's a new mass growing in the body, are likely to be in hypoxic conditions because they're a long way from the blood supply. So these low oxygen conditions cause the cells to change their metabolism. The normal oxidation phosphorylation of healthy cells is switched to a part of the metabolic cycle called glycolysis, as a result of which there's lactic acid, which is given off, and so the pH goes down. Healthy cells will do this, and cramp, which is experienced by athletes from overexertion, is a result of doing that. Now, when the oxygen is restored, healthy cells just go back to the normal way of doing things. Cancer cells actually seem to prefer this glycolytic cycle. They prefer these low pH, low oxygen conditions. It actually gives them an advantage. They can outcompete healthy cells as a result of being adapted to these conditions. So even when the oxygen comes back, they actually, the claim is, prefer the hypoxic conditions and the glycolytic cycle. So it's something called the Warburg effect. It was noticed many decades ago. And it's obviously an intriguing clue. Cancer cells simply look different from healthy cells. Somebody, George, you might remember, made the comment that they look angry. So a pathologist can tell if cells are cancerous because the cells look angry. Well, their morphology changes, not only the cellular morphology, but the nuclear morphology. And one of our research programs here is to study that very carefully with a three-dimensional imaging system. They also change their elastic properties, another of our research programs. They become generally softer. This seems to confer abilities on them to be able to squeeze through little gaps, so enter the bloodstream and exit in this extravasation process. Very distinctively different viscoelastic properties. In order to move around, they can secrete membrane-dissolving chemicals. Think of melanoma, for example. If it remains on the surface of the skin, the outcome can be very good. You just remove it. But once it's dissolved its way through the basement membrane and it's out into the body, then it's one of the worst cancers of all. And so these cells have the ability to drill little tunnels to further their agenda, so it seems to me. They become mobile. They enter the bloodstream. I've mentioned that. They have the ability to grow in foreign organs. You take a liver cell and put it in the lung, it doesn't do very well. It gets all the wrong growth factors, the wrong signals from its tissue microenvironment, and it very soon dies. But a cancer cell has the ability to make a home in foreign territory. And furthermore, these clever cells can recruit some of the local tribes. I mean, it's a little bit like the early settlement of the United States, that these boats came over, forts were built. The early settlers sort of kept their heads down for a bit, but eventually they bribed a few of the native tribes and then eventually burst out, and the rest is history. So you see a similar sort of thing here, that the cancer cells can recruit and subvert healthy cells and change the nature of the extracellular matrix to improve their prospects in the metastatic site. So again, all this looks like a pre-programmed, organized strategy. I mentioned they can organize their own blood supply and other things as well. It goes on, they evade the immune system and can evolve resistance to chemotherapy and so on. Charlie Lyon, let me just show this first. This picture here, another of the gross changes which take place in cancer cells at the chromosome level, is transpositions between chromosomes. Whole chunks of chromosomes get swapped and switched around, and then there's another condition called aneuploidy, where cancer cells have the wrong number of chromosomes. For example, Carlo Maley and I were talking about how if cells go through the cell cycle and they don't undergo mitosis correctly, that you end up with tetraploidy. So you have four instead of two lots of chromosomes. And then thereafter, when the cells divide, you can have all sorts of muddle. And so these look like monster cells. And to me, one of the great paradoxes of cancer is that you make such a mess of the genetic material of these cells, and yet this seems to confer extraordinary survival abilities on them. You would expect that if you went into the nucleus of a cell with a little sledgehammer and smashed up all the chromosomes, you would kill the cell in pretty quick order. And yet, when you look at the karyotype, as it's called, of cancer cells, it seems to be chaotic and highly heterogeneous. And so what we're dealing with here are cells that look like monsters that should not survive, and yet they do, and they seemingly survive even better than healthy cells. So one of the puzzles. Well, I mentioned that Charlie Lineweaver and I produced this paper, it's throwing down the gauntlet, that we think that we can trace the origin of cancer back to the dawn of multicellularity, and that really was the motivation behind this meeting here. This is an attempt at providing some sort of overarching theory of cancer, a framework at least, and I hope we can make some progress discussing some of these ideas. This paper was published last year in the journal Physical Biology. One reason that we got into this is that the standard picture, which is certainly contains a lot of truth, nobody would deny, is that within the host of an organism, a neoplasm, a collection of these new cancer cells, is going to undergo Darwinian evolution, of course, replication, variation, and selection. And the standard picture seems to be that the survival traits of cancer, as deployed in the systematic manner I have been talking about, are the result of Darwinian evolution. And so that as the body and the physician attack the cancer in various ways, there's always a subpopulation which can evade that particular attack and go on and spread. And so that is the standard picture. What we're saying is we have to add to that. That's clearly correct, but we're saying it's not the whole story, that we believe it's a pre-programmed response to stress, if you like, an accident waiting to happen, and that the origin of that accident goes way back in history. Now, the reason that Charlie and I are attracted to this idea is, I think, with our background in astrobiology, because a lot of cancer research, quite rightly, is treating cancer as a human disease that we want to do something about, cure if possible, manage if not. But it would be a mistake to think that cancer is just a condition of human beings. It pervades the biosphere, and the first thing that you discover is that even among fish and plants and certainly other mammals, with the possible exception of the naked mole rat, it seems that cancer is widespread. So it's something widespread in the biosphere, and when you see something that is widespread like that, you suspect it has very deep evolutionary origins. This isn't just some recent sort of thing. The trigger for the paper that Charlie and I published came about 18 months ago when I was reading this particular paper in Nature, and this is gene sequencing of a sponge, an Australian sponge as it happens, with the discovery that it contains tumour suppressor genes, even in a sponge, with a lineage going back 600 million years. And the phrase at the bottom leapt out at me: many of the genes associated with the emergence of animals are also implicated in cancer, which arises from defects in basic processes associated with metazoan multicellularity. And hence we assembled together our arguments in that paper, and the response has tended to be along the lines of, why don't you physical scientists stay out of biology, you don't know what you're talking about, and, well, we knew this all along. So we sort of figured we got something right anyway. And it could well be that everything we've said in that paper is known to somebody, What we're trying to do, as I've explained, the whole idea of this PSOC exercise, I believe, is for us to be able to survey the scientific scene across the sciences and collect from wherever is relevant the necessary bits of information and assemble them to make a picture, ultimately, I hope, a theory of cancer. So it's not so much that there's anything terribly new here, but that maybe it hasn't been packaged in quite the way it has now. Now, for the non-astrobiologists here, I always like to show the oldest traces of life on Earth. Not the oldest possible traces, because we may do better than this, but the oldest traces which are not truly contentious come here from Western Australia. The rocks jutting out of the hills there are 3.5 billion years old. Our planet is 4.5 billion years old, so there's been life on it for a substantial fraction of its history. But 3.5 billion years of life on Earth, most of that time it's been single-celled organisms alone. And about 1 billion years ago, things began to change, and a very interesting, challenging problem in astrobiology and evolutionary biology is what was it that led first to eukaryogenesis, the formation of complex eukaryotic cells, and then paved the way to multicellularity. A popular idea was the rise of oxygen. I'll come back to that in a moment. So I'm grateful to Carlo Maley for the next slide, which I adapted from a talk he gave here last year. He'll recognize fragments of it. We often will read about the so-called Cambrian explosion. Stephen Jay Gould was famous for popularizing this 550, can't remember the exact date, million years or so ago, a riot of new multicellular forms, the beginning of modern metazoan world as we now know it. Today we know that this was preceded by the so-called Ediacaran explosion. This was an earlier skirmish, an attempt at multicellularity. The Ediacara Hills, just north of Adelaide in South Australia, fossils discovered there in the 1950s, now known to represent something really quite different from the Cambrian explosion organisms. So that story is still being pieced together. But the point is what we're seeing here is what Charlie and I call Metazoa 2.0. We're seeing modern type organisms with many different cell types, differentiated cell types, and organ compartmentalization, as it were, just like us. Of course, they don't look just like us, but they're on the way. Now, this transition from single cellularity to multicellularity, when you read a popular account of biology, it looks like, you know, ho-hum, one more step down the road to mankind or something like that. What went on was, from the logical point of view, really very dramatic, because back in the unicellular world, Earth is still dominated by single-celled organisms. There's but one imperative: replicate, replicate, replicate. So at the top here, we see the single-celled world. You just want to make more of the same. But multicellularity involved a very different way of doing things, because cells had to gather together in an organized way. And what you see at the top is, in effect, immortality. So long as nothing devastating happens, the single-celled world can just go on and on and on. Any big given organism can replicate indefinitely, so long as resources are provided. But in the multicellular world, this immortality gets outsourced to specialized germ cells. And the price that the rest pay for that outsourcing, the somatic cells, is programmed cell death, which I already mentioned. So it's a very different way of doing life. The evolutionary pressures leading up to the emergence of multicellularity, not at all understood, probably involving some sort of group selection. But a very, very drastic step. So drastic, you might have thought that it would happen only once, but in fact it's happened many times independently in evolutionary history. Not sure exactly how many times, I've actually read 50 somewhere, but what you see here are other branches. Here are us animals, but fungi represent a separate lineage, and slime molds and so on. However great this transformation is from single cellularity to multicellularity, clearly it confers a substantial advantage. Now, Charlie provided me with this phylogenetic tree here, and we see just the division into animals, plants, and fungi with their common ancestors, dating way back, I hope you can see it from there, way back to 1,600 million years ago. And it's another way of saying that multicellularity has evolved independently many times, because the last common ancestor, say, of plants and animals, probably predates predates multicellularity. Raises some interesting questions for astrobiologists, I think. Were the roots of cancer already present in the single cells that predated this multicellular experiment? Or is somehow cancer part and parcel of the multicellular story? In other words, is there something about the logical structure of multicellularity that makes something like cancer inevitable? And if we found life on Europa or Titan or another Earth-like planet and it was multicellular life, would we expect cancer to come along with it? So is it just something about that way of doing life, or is it something that was already there in the in the single-celled antecedents? Well, I've mentioned that animals and plants have a cancer. What about the other groups like fungi and ciliate and slime molds and so on? I think the answer seems to be very few people have thought about this, very few people have looked. We know how to induce cancers in mammals, say radiation, carcinogens, and so on. It would be very easy to, and I think we'll have a little bit of discussion of this later in the meeting, to attempt to induce cancers in these other organisms, because my feeling is that we're only going to understand cancer within the context of the great story of life itself. That if we focus on it as a human disease, we're never going to get to the bottom of it. But seeing it as part of the story of life is the way to make progress. And so we need to understand, is there something like cancer, maybe a cancer analog, in these other orders as well? And that's clearly something that can yield to experiment. Now, I said something about hypoxia. This is Warburg. I mentioned the Warburg effect, the lowering of the pH. You don't need to go into these details. But this is a wild conjecture, but it's fun for astrobiologists to think about, that I showed you in that picture earlier, that multicellularity seems to have begun the first glimmerings around about 1,200 million years ago. And at that time, the oxygen content of the Earth's atmosphere was substantially lower. Now, it turns out it's a bit of a mixed story. Carl will probably, Chris McKay probably tell us more. There's a lot of guesswork in here, but basically there were two great rises in oxygen on Earth, one of them here, 2 billion years ago, and then it sort of plateaued for a bit, and then there was another big rise, maybe between a billion and a few hundred million years ago. And if we're right that the roots of cancer lie with the origin of multicellularity, it does seem to coincide with this lower oxygen environment. And so one has to wonder whether the hypoxic preference of cancer cells in some ways reflects this hypoxic origin a long time ago. I'm going to gallop through the next few slides because we're running out of time. It's interesting that if you go to the Abaco Island in the Bahamas, there are these sinkholes, and here's somebody swimming down. They're so deep that the organisms at the bottom are living naturally in hypoxic conditions. And there's been astrobiologists have studied, Jennifer McAlady in particular, the prokaryotic inhabitants of the deep. And it's interesting to wonder about the eukaryotic inhabitants, because these single-celled eukaryotes living down there would be the closest, as it were, natural analog to cancer. So that's a job for an astrobiologist who is also a scuba diver. Anyway, the central claim of the theory that Charlie and I are developing, he's going to talk in a moment and take it a little bit further, is that cancer is some sort of atavism. I don't need to remind people here what atavism is. I mean, it's genes which represent an earlier stage of development, which are normally silenced, can occasionally be reawakened. And this is an example of a dolphin with four fins. And there are many other examples known. And the question, if cancer is something like a throwback or an atavism to the dawn of multicellularity, that why has nature retained this ability when cancer is clearly bad news for the host organism? Why wouldn't it be eliminated? And the answer, we think, is that because these genes are also active in early stage embryogenesis. And I'm looking forward to hearing the talks that will be dealing with this. And so there's no reason for me to dwell too much on this, as I'm sure you know, that the embryo, the human embryo, a long time ago, you had gills and a tail, and I think even webbed feet. These features have gone away, but the genes representing earlier stages in our ancestral history are still inside us. And so what we're claiming is that there's a toolkit of genes which dates back right to that early stage of multicellularity, which Charlie and I call Metazoa 1.0. That is the loose, quasi-organized assemblages of cells that predated modern metazoa. That the genes that went to build those microorganisms are still inside us because they lay down the basic body plan in the early stages of embryogenesis. And normally they're silenced thereafter. But if something reawakens them, another analogy I like to use is it's a little bit like your computer starting up in safe mode. In other words, that life defaults to a tried and tested, robust method of building multicellular assemblages, which today we might call tumours or neoplasms. But if you got in a time machine and went back a billion years, you might say, well, they look rather like sponges, or they look rather like tumours. That would be the Metazoa 1.0 we're talking about. So what we see here then is an intersection between the three groups of people represented here today: cancer biologists, developmental biologists, and evolutionary biologists. Groups who don't often talk to each other, I might say. And I hope that as a result of this meeting, there will be more dialogue and hopefully a meeting of minds to try to build on this agenda. Probably I don't need to dwell too much on the background to the connections between embryos and cancer, but I assembled this slide for a talk I gave to NASA last week, so I'll show it to you anyway. That it was realized a long time ago by a Scottish physician by the name of Beard that the placenta rather resembles a cancer in as much as it invades the mother's body. It organizes its own blood supply, and it also has to evade the mother's immune system, and cancer seems to do all these things as well. So it's an analogy, but an interesting one. The early stage embryo consists of undifferentiated cells. Cancer, one of its properties is it de-differentiates, and that's the secret for cells being able to invade other organs. They lose their organ of origin identity, or it becomes blurred, so these de-differentiate. The early stage of the embryo involves high degree of motility, the way the cells are reorganized. We'll hear about this later on. And cancer as well spreads because it becomes highly motile, and rapid proliferation as well. One intriguing thing I dug out just from a Google search last week. Oh, I should just mention, because I became interested in the link here from meeting Marilyn Monk last year, some years ago she found that human embryonic genes were re-expressed in cancer, and that provides a clue. We're going to hear more about that in talks later on today. And John, sitting over there, was a collaborator of Marilyn's at some stage, and will tell us more about that in due course. This is a report on experiments of using cancer cells to actually create embryos. So it's another intriguing link. I just want to finish up with a couple more slides here. The fetus will produce certain antigens which have been found to be re-expressed in tumor cells. And this has been known for a number of years, and here's a quotation from this paper. Therefore, it can be postulated that the synthesis of fetal antigens, or the phenotypic expression of these antigens, which are undetectable in normal adult cells, may reappear after malignant transformation of the cells. And so another clue, but I'm of course not an expert in this area. People in this room are, so I'm not going to dwell too much on this. Charlie and I are certainly not the first people to see some sort of link between cancer and ancient life. There's a paper here by Peter Duisberg and colleagues, Is Carcinogenesis a Form of Speciation? One thing that I think could be significant, probably not for this workshop, but for one we're going to have in March, cancer cells use only a minute fraction of the information of their normal predecessors to establish a primitive form of autonomy similar to that of microbes. So again, we see the sort of throwback idea, running on a minimal toolkit of an inner core of genes that can run life in an ancient mode. It's a paper by David Krakow on Darwinian demons and evolutionary complexity that I've become intrigued by, it's going to take us a little bit out of the subject here, but I'll just gabble through this. The amount of information present in the winning genome is the maximum quantity that can be propagated reliably given a budget for metabolic free energy apportioned to genetic repair. So the point here seems to be that all cells devote some of their energy budget to error correction. Cancer is famous for its genetic instability. Is this a result of the cell running with a reduced energy budget due to glycolysis and hypoxia, devoting its resources just to servicing that inner core of really essential genes, the atavistic core, that perfectly happily runs the cancer? And the genetic instability that is so famous of cancer is just a result of the rest being allowed to go to pot. Anyway, Krakow's developed a scaling law that the genome length should be proportional to the body mass of the 1/4. He talks about effective genome theory. The effective genome of cancer cells encodes a small subset of cellular functions, so their effective genome size is far smaller. Captures the same point as I've just made on the previous slide, that there is an inner core of genes. And if this is right, we ought to be able to discover a scaling law for the cancer cassette that would fit into this. A prediction of our model, if there is this cassette of ancient genes, that this should be highly conserved, that in this amid this genetic instability so famous of cancer cells, if there's a core of genes that are really driving the key functions, we should find that they are not unstable. And the Cancer Genome Atlas provides one window into the possibility of testing that hypothesis.